As trusted as Nick Thompson was, Jack couldn't know how much clearance he had. The good news was that Thompson knew what not to ask. "So your father was a police officer?"
"Detective, yeah. Mainly homicide.
Did that for more than 20 years.
He topped out at lieutenant.
Said captains never got to do anything more than administrative stuff, and Dad wasn't into that. He liked busting bad guys and sending them to the joint.
The what?
Prison. The Maryland State Prison is one evil-looking structure in Baltimore. But Jones Falls. Kind of like a medieval fortress, but more forbidding. The inmates call it Frankenstein's Castle.
Fine with me, Sir John. I've never had much sympathy for murderers.
Dad didn't talk about them much. Didn't bring his work home. Mom didn't like hearing about it. Except once. A father killed his son over a crab cake. That's like a little hamburger made out of crab meat, Jack explained. Dad said it seemed like a shitty thing to get killed over. The father, the killer, copped right out, all broken up about it. But it didn't do his son much good. Amazing how many murderers react that way. They gather up the rage to take a life, then afterwards they are consumed by remorse. "Too soon old, too late smart," Jack quoted from the Old West.
Indeed. The whole business can be so bloody sad.
What about this Strokov guy?
Different color of horse entirely, Thompson replied.
You don't see many of those. For them, it's part of the job, ending a life. No motive in the usual sense, and they leave little behind in the way of physical evidence. They can be very difficult to find, but mainly we do find them. We have time on our side, and sooner or later someone talks and it gets to our ear. Most criminals talk their own way into prison, Nick explained.
But people like this Strokov fellow, they do not talk. Except when he gets home and writes up his official report. But we never see those.
Getting a line on him was plain luck. Mr. Markov remembered being poked by the umbrella, remembered the color suit the man was wearing. One of our constables saw him wearing the same suit and thought there was something odd about him. You know, instead of flying right home, he waited to make sure Markov died. They'd bungled two previous attempts, you see, and so they called him in because of his expertise. Good professional, Strokov. He wanted to be completely sure, and he waited to read the death notice in the newspapers. In that time, we talked to the staff at his hotel and started assembling information. The security service got involved, and they were helpful in some ways, but not in others. And the government got involved. The government was worried about creating an international incident, and so they held us up. Cost us 2 days, I reckon. On the first of those 2 days, Strokov took a taxi to Heathrow and flew off to Paris. I was on the surveillance team, stood within 15 feet of him. We had 2 detectives with cameras, shot a lot of pictures. The last was of Strokov walking down the jetway to the Boeing. Next day, the government gave us permission to detain him for questioning.
Day late and a dollar short, huh?
Thompson nodded.
Quite.
I would have liked to put him in the dock at the Old Bailey, but that fish got away. The French shadowed him at De Gaulle International, but he never left the international terminal, never talked with anyone. The bugger showed no remorse at all. I suppose for him, it was like chopping firewood, the former detective said.
Yeah.
In the movies, you make your hit and have a martini. Shaken, not stirred. But it's different when you kill a good guy. All Markov ever did was broadcast over BBC World Service, Nick said, gripping the wheel a little tightly. I imagine the people in Sofia were somewhat put out with what he said. The people on the other side of the curtain aren't real big on freedom of speech, Ryan reminded him. Bloody barbarians.
And now this chap is planning to kill the Pope. I am not a Catholic, but he is a man of God, and he seems rather a good chap. You know, the most vicious criminal hesitates before trifling with a man of the clergy.
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't do to piss God off.
But they don't believe in God, Nick.
Fortunate for them that I am not God.
Yeah, it would be nice to have the power to right all the wrongs in the world.
The problem is that's what Strokov's bosses think they're doing.
That is why we have laws, Jack.
Yes, I know. They make up their own.
That's the problem, Jack agreed as they came into Chatham.
This is a pleasant area, Thompson said, turning up the hill on City Way.
Not a bad neighborhood.
Kathy likes it. I would have preferred closer to London, but, well, she got her way.
Women usually do.
Thompson chuckled, turning right onto Fristow Way and then left on Grisdale Close. And there was the house. Ryan got out and retrieved his bags.
"Daddy!" Sally screamed when he walked in the door.
Ryan dropped his bags and scooped her up. Little girls, he'd long since learned, gave the best hugs, though their kisses tended to be a little sloppy.
"How's my little Sally?"
"Fine." It was oddly like a cat coming out of her mouth.
"Oh, hello, Dr. Ryan," Miss Margaret said in greeting. "I didn't expect you."
"Just making a low pass. Have to change cleans for dirties and head back out."
"You going away again?" Sally asked, with crushing disappointment in her voice.
"Sorry, Sally. Daddy has business." Sally wriggled out of his arms.
"Phooey!"
And she went back to the TV, putting her father firmly in his place. Jack took the cue to go upstairs. 4 clean shirts, 5 sets of underwear, 4 new ties, and, yes, some casual wear, too. 2 new jackets, 2 pairs of slacks. His marine tie bar. That about did it. He left the pile of dirties on the bed and, with his bags packed, headed back down. Whoops. He set his bags down and went back upstairs for his passport. No sense using the fake Brit one anymore. Bye, Sally.
Bye, Daddy.
But then she thought again and jumped to her feet to give him another hug. She wouldn't grow up to break hearts, but to rip them out and cook them over charcoal. But that was a long way off, and for now her father had the chance to enjoy her. Little Jack was asleep on his back in the playpen, and his father decided not to disturb him.
"See you, buddy," Ryan said as he turned to the door.
"Where are you going?" Miss Margaret asked.
"Out of the country. Business," Jack explained. "I'll call Kathy from the airport."
"Good trip, Dr. Ryan."
"Thanks, Margaret."
And back out the door. "How are we on time?" Ryan asked, back in the car.
"No problem," Thompson thought out loud. If they were late, this airliner, too, would have a minor mechanical problem.
"Good." Jack adjusted his seat to lean back and get a few winks. He awoke just outside Heathrow Terminal 3. Thompson drove up to where a man in civilian clothes was standing. He looked like some sort of government worker. He was. As soon as Ryan alighted from the car, the man came over with a ticket envelope.
"Sir, your flight leaves in 40 minutes, gate 12, the man reported. "You'll be met in Rome by Tom Sharp."
"What's he look like?" Jack asked.
"He will know you, sir."
"Fair enough." Ryan took the tickets and headed to the back of the car for his bags.
"I'll take care of that for you, sir."
This sort of traveling had its possibilities, Jack thought. He waved at Thompson and headed into the terminal, looking for gate 12. That proved easy enough. Ryan took a seat close by the gate and checked his ticket. 1A again, a first-class ticket. The SIS must have had a comfortable understanding with British Airways. Now all he had to do was survive the flight. He boarded 20 minutes later,
sitting down, strapping in, and turning his watch forward 1 hour. He endured the usual rigmarole of useless safety briefing and instructions on how to buckle his seatbelt, which in Jack's case was already clicked and snugged in. The flight took 2 hours, depositing Jack at Leonardo da Vinci Airport at 3:09 local time. Jack walked off the aircraft and looked for the Blue Channel to get his diplomatic passport stamped, after a wait of about 5 seconds. One other diplomat had been ahead of him, and the bonehead had forgotten which pocket his passport was in. With that done, he retrieved his bags off the carousel and headed out. A man with a gray and brown beard seemed to be eyeballing him.
"You're Jack Ryan?"
"You must be Tom Sharp."
"Correct. Let me help you with your bags."
Why people did this, Ryan didn't know, though on reflection he'd done it himself often enough, and the Brits were the world champions at good manners.
"And you are?" Ryan asked. "Station Chief Rome," Sharp replied. "C called to say you were coming in, Sir John, and that I ought to meet you personally."
Good of Basil, Jack thought out loud. Sharp's car was, in this case, a Bentley sedan, bronze in color, with left-hand driver's seat in deference to the fact that they were in a barbarian country.
"Nice wheels, fellow." "My cover is Deputy Chief of Mission," Sharp explained. "I could have had a Ferrari, but it seemed a little too ostentatious. I do little actual field work, you see, just administrative things. I actually am the DCM of the embassy."
"Too much diplomatic work. That can drive one mad."
"How's Italy?"
"Lovely place. Lovely people. Not terribly well organized. They say we Brits muddle through things, but we're bloody Prussians compared to this lot."
"They're cops?"
"Quite good, actually. Several different police forces. Best of the lot are the Carabinieri, paramilitary police of the central government. Some of them are excellent. Down in Sicily they're trying to get a handle on the Mafia. Pig of a job that is, but, you know, eventually I think they will succeed."
"You briefed in on why they sent me down?"
"Some people think Yuri Vladimirovich wants to kill the Pope. That's what my telex said."
"Yeah, we just got a defector out who says so, and we think he's giving us the real shit."
"Any details?"
"Afraid not. I think they sent me down here to work with you until somebody figures out the right thing to do. Looks to me like an attempt might be made Wednesday."
"The Wheatley appearance in the square?"
Jack nodded.
"Yep." They were on the highway from the airport to Rome. The country looked odd to Ryan, but it took a minute to figure out why. Then he got it. The pitch of the roofs was different, shallower than what he was used to. They probably didn't get much snow here in winter. Otherwise, the houses looked rather like sugar cubes, painted white to reject the heat of the Italian sun. Well, every country had its unique architecture.
"Wednesday, eh?"
"Yeah. We're also looking for a guy named Boris Strokov, colonel in the Bulgarian DS. Sounds like a professional killer." Sharp concentrated on the road.
"I've heard the name. Wasn't he a suspect in the Georgi Markov killing?"
"That's the guy. They ought to be sending some photos of him."
"Courier on your flight," Sharp reported, "taking a different way into the city."
"Any ideas on what the hell to do?"
"We'll get you settled at the embassy. My house, actually, 2 blocks away. It's rather nice. Then we'll drive down to St. Peter's and look around, get a feel for things. I've been there to see the artwork and such. The Vatican art collection is on a par with the Queen's, but I've never worked there per se."
"Ever been to Rome?"
"Never." "Very well. Let's take a drive about first instead. Give you a quick feel for the place."
Rome seemed a remarkably disorganized place, but so did a street map of London, whose city fathers had evidently not been married to the city mothers. And Rome was older by 1,000 years or so, built when the fastest thing going was a horse,
and they were slower in real life than in a John Ford Western. Not many straight lines for the roads, and a meandering river in the middle. Everything looked old to Ryan. No, not old, but old, as though dinosaurs had once walked the streets. That was a little hard to reconcile with the automobile traffic, of course. That's the Flavian Amphitheater. It was called the Colosseum because the Emperor Nero had built a large statue of himself right there, Sharp pointed, and the people took to calling the stadium by that name, rather to the annoyance of the Flavian family, which built the place out of proceeds from the Jewish rebellion that Josephus wrote about. Jack had seen it on TV and in the movies, but that wasn't quite the same as driving past it. Men had built that with nothing more than sweat, power, and hemp ropes. Its shape was strangely reminiscent of Yankee Stadium in New York. But Babe Ruth had never spilled the guy's guts out in the Bronx. A lot of that had happened here. It was time for Ryan to make an admission. You know, if they ever invent a time machine, I think I might like to come back and see what it was like. Makes me a barbarian, doesn't it? Just their version of rugby, Sharp said. And the football here can be pretty tough. Soccer is a girl's game, Jack snorted. You are a barbarian, Sir John. Soccer, he explained in his best accent, is a gentleman's game played by thugs, while rugby is a thug's game played by gentlemen. I'll take your word for it. I just want to see the International Tribune. My baseball team's in the World Series, and I don't even know how it's going. Baseball? Oh, you mean rounders. Yes, that is a girl's game, Sharp announced. I've had this talk before. You Brits just don't understand. As you do not understand proper football, Sir John, in Italy it's even more a national passion than at home. They tend to play a fiery game, rather different from the Germans, for example, who play like great bloody machines. It was like listening to the distinction between a curveball and a slider, or a screwball and a forkball. Ryan wasn't all that good a baseball fan to be able to grasp all the distinctions. It depended on the TV announcer, who probably just made it up anyway. But he knew that there wasn't a player in baseball who could smack a good curveball on the outside corner. St. Peter's Basilica was 5 minutes after that. Damn, Jack breathed. Big, isn't it? It wasn't big. It was vast. Sharp went to the left side of the cathedral, ending up in what looked like an area of shops. Jewelry, it seemed, where he parked. Let's take a look, shall we? Ryan took the chance to leave the car and stretch his legs. And he had to remind himself that he was not here to admire the architecture of Bramante and Michelangelo. He was here to scout the terrain for a mission, as he had been taught to plan for at Quantico. It wasn't really all that hard if he spoke the language. From above, it must have looked like an old-fashioned basketball key. The circular part of the piazza looked to be a good 200 yards in diameter, then narrowed down to perhaps a third of that as you got away from the monstrous bronze doors to the church itself. When he sees the crowd, he boards his car, rather like a cross between a jeep and a golf trolley, just there, and he follows a cleared path in the crowd along this way, Sharp explained, around here and back. Takes about, 20 minutes or so, depending on whether he stops the car for what you Americans call pressing the flesh. I suppose I shouldn't compare him to a politician. He seems a very decent chap, a genuinely good man. Not all the popes have been so, but this one is. And he's no coward. He's had to live through the Nazis and the communists, and that never turned him a single degree from his path. Yeah, he must like riding the point of the lance, Ryan murmured in reply. There was just one thing occupying his mind now. Where's the sun going to be? Just at our backs. So if there's a bad guy, he'll stand just about here, sun behind him, not in his eyes.
People looking that way from the other side have the sun in their eyes. Maybe it's not all that much, but when your ass is on the line, you play every card in your hand. Ever been in uniform, Tom?
Coldstream Guards, lieutenant through a captaincy. Saw some action in Arden, but mainly served in the Boer.
I agree with your estimate of the situation, Sharp said, turning to do his own evaluation.
And professionals are somewhat predictable, since they all study out at the same syllabus. But what about a rifle?
How many men do you have to use for this?
4, besides myself. C might send more down from London, but not all that many.
Put one up there?
Ryan gestured to the colonnade.
70 feet high.
80?
About the same height as the perch Lee Harvey Oswald had used to do Jack Kennedy.
With an Italian rifle, Jack reminded himself.
That was good for a brief chill.
I can probably get a man up there disguised as a photographer.
And long camera lenses made for good telescopes. How about radios?
Say 6 civilian band walkie-talkies. If we don't have them at the embassy, I can have them flown in from London.
Better to have military ones, small enough to conceal. We had one in the Corps that had an earpiece, like from a transistor radio.
Also better if it's encrypted, but that might be hard.
And such systems, Ryan didn't add, are not entirely reliable.
Yes, we can do that. You have a good eye, Sir John.
I wasn't a Marine for long, but the way they teach lessons in the basic school, it's kind of hard to forget them. This is one hell of a big place to cover with 6 men, fella.
And not something SIS trains us to do, Sharp added.
Hey, the U.S. Secret Service would cover this place with over 100 trained agents. Shit, maybe more. Plus, try to get intel on every hotel, motel, and flophouse in the area.
Jack let out a breath.
Mr. Sharp, this is not possible. How thick are the crowds?
It varies. In the summer tourist season, there are enough people here to fill Wembley Stadium. This coming week, certainly thousands, he estimated. How many is hard to reckon?
This mission is a real shitburger, Ryan told himself. Any way to hit the hotels? Try to get a line on this Strokov guy.
More hotels in Rome than in London. It's a lot to cover with 4 field officers. We can't get any help from the local police, can we?
What guidance on that from Basil? Ryan inquired, already guessing the answer.
Everything is on close hold. No, we cannot let anyone know what we are doing.
He couldn't even call for help from CIA's local station, Jack realized. Bob Ritter would never sanction it. Shitburger was optimistic.
Chapter 31. Bridge Builder. Sharp's official residence was as impressive in its way as the safe house outside Manchester. There was no guessing what, whom it had been built for, and Ryan was tired of asking anyway. He had a bedroom and a private bathroom, and that was enough. The ceilings were high in every room, presumably defense against the hot summers Rome was known for. It had been about 80 during the afternoon drive, warm but not too bad for someone from the Baltimore-Washington area, though to an Englishman it must have seemed like the very boiler room of hell. Whoever had written about mad dogs and Englishmen must have lived in another age, Jack thought. In London, people started dropping dead in the street when it got to 75. As it was, he thought he had 3 days to worry, and one in which to execute whatever plan he and Sharp managed to come up with, in the hope that nothing at all would happen, and that CIA would come up with a way to warn His Holiness's security troops that they needed to firm up their means of seeing to his physical safety. Christ, the guy even wore white. The better to make a perfect sight picture for whatever gun the bad guy might use. Like a great big paper target blank for the bad guy to put his rounds into. George Armstrong Custer hadn't walked into a worse tactical environment, but at least he'd done it with open eyes, albeit clouded by lethal pride and faith in his own luck. The Pope didn't live under that illusion. No, he believed that God would come and collect him whenever it suited his purpose, and that was that. Ryan's personal beliefs were not all that different from the Polish priest's, but he figured that God had given him brains and free will for a reason. Did that make Jack an instrument of God's will? It was too deep a question for the moment, and besides, Ryan wasn't a priest to dope that one out. Maybe it was a lack of faith. Maybe he believed in the real world too much. His wife's job was to fix health problems, and were those problems visited upon people by God himself? Some thought so. Or were those problems things God merely allowed to happen so that people like Kathy could fix them and thus do his work? Ryan tended to this view, and the church must have agreed since it had built so many hospitals across the world. But for damn sure the Lord God didn't approve of murder, and it was now Jack's mission to stop one from happening, if that was possible. Certainly he wasn't one to stand by and ignore it. A priest would have to limit himself to persuasion, or at most, passive interference. Ryan knew that if he saw a criminal drawing a bead on the Pope, or for that matter anyone else, and he had a gun in his hand, he wouldn't hesitate more than a split second to interrupt the act with a pistol bullet of his own. Maybe that was just how he was made up. Maybe it was the things he'd learned from his dad. Maybe it was his training in the green machine, but for whatever reason, the use of physical force would not make him faint away. At least, not until after he'd done the act. There were a few people in hell to prove that fact. And so Jack started the mental preparation for what he'd have to do, maybe, if the bad guys were in town and he saw them. Then it hit him that he wouldn't even have to answer for it. Not with diplomatic status. The State Department had the right to withdraw his protection under the Vienna Convention, but no, not in a case like this they wouldn't. So whatever he did could be a freebie. And that wasn't so bad a deal, was it? The Sharps took him out for dinner. Just a neighborhood place, but the food was brilliant. Renewed proof that the best Italian restaurants are often the little mom-and-pop places. Evidently, the Sharps ate there often. The staff was so friendly to them. "Tom, what the hell are we going to do?" Jack asked openly, figuring that Annie had to know what he did for a living. "Churchill called it KBO. Keep buggering on." He shrugged. "We do the best we can, Jack." "I suppose I'd feel a hell of a lot better with a platoon of Marines to back my play." "As would I, my boy. But one does the best one can with what one has."
"Tommy," Mrs. Sharp said, "what exactly are you two talking about?"
"Can't say, my dear."
"But you are CIA, she said next, looking at Jack.
"Yes, ma'am," Ryan confirmed. "Before that, I taught history at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And before that, I traded stocks. And before that, I was a Marine."
"Sir John, you're the one who..."
"And I'll never live it down, either." Why the hell, Jack wondered, hadn't he just kept his wife and daughter behind that tree on the Mall in London and let Sean Miller do his thing? Kathy would have gotten some pictures, and that would have helped with the police, after all. No good or dumb deed ever went unpunished, he supposed. "And you can stop the Sir John stuff. I do not own a horse or a steel shirt." And his only sword was the Mameluke that the Marine Corps gave to its officers upon graduation at Quantico.
"Jack, a knight is ceremonially one who will take up arms in protection of the sovereign. You've done that twice, if memory serves. You are, therefore, entitled to the honorific," Sharp pointed out.
"You guys never forget, do you?"
"Not something like that, Sir John. Courage under fire is one of the things worth remembering. Especially in nightmares. But in those, the gun never works. And yeah, sometimes I have them," Jack admitted, for the first time in his life. "What are we doing tomorrow, Tom?" I have embassy work in the morning. Why don't you scout the area some more, and I can join you for lunch?
Fair enough. Meet where?
Just inside the basilica, to the right, is Michelangelo's Pietà. Just there at 1:15 exactly.
Fair enough, Jack agreed.
So, where is Ryan? The rabbit asked.
Rome, Alan Kingshot answered. He's looking into what you told us.
All of this day had been occupied with uncovering what he knew of KGB operations in the UK. It turned out to be quite a lot, enough that the three-man security service team had positively drooled as they took their notes. Ryan had been wrong, Kingshot thought over dinner. This fellow wasn't a gold mine. No, he was Kimberly, and the diamonds just spilled out from his mouth.
Zaitsev was relaxing a little more, enjoying his status.
As well he might, Alan thought. Like the man who'd invented the computer chip, this rabbit was set for life. All the carrots he could eat, and men with guns would protect his hole in the ground against all bears.
The bunny, as he thought of her, had discovered Western cartoons today. She especially liked Roadrunner, immediately noting the similarity to the Russian "Hey, wait a minute," and laughing through every one of them. Irina, on the other hand, was rediscovering her love for the piano, playing the big Bösendorfer in the home's music room, making mistakes but learning from them, and starting to recover her former skills to the admiring looks of Mrs. Thompson, who'd never learned to play herself, but who'd found reams of sheet music in the house for Mrs. Zaitsev to try her hand at. This family, Kingshot thought, will do well in the West. The child was a child. The father had tons of good information. The mother would breathe free and play her music to her heart's content. They would wear their newfound freedom like a loose and comfortable garment. They were, to use the Russian word, kulturni, or cultured people, fit representatives of the rich culture which had long predated communism. Good to know that not all defectors were alcoholic ruffians.
Like a canary on amphetamines, Basil says, Moore told his senior people in the den of his home. He says this guy will give us more information than we can easily use.
Oh, yeah? Try us, Ritter thought out loud.
Indeed, Bob. When do we get him over here? Admiral Greer asked.
Basil asked for 2 more days to get him over. See, Thursday afternoon. I'm having the Air Force send a VC-137 over.
Might as well do it first class, the judge observed generously. It wasn't his money, after all.
Basil's alerted his people in Rome, by the way, just in case KGB is running fast on their operation to whack the Pope.
They're not that efficient, Ritter said with some confidence.
I'd be careful about that, Bob, the DDI thought out loud. Yuri Vladimirovich isn't noted for his patience.
Greer was not the first man to make that observation.
I know, but their system grinds slower than ours.
What about the Bulgarians? Moore asked.
They think the shooter is a guy named Strokov, Boris Strokov. He's probably the guy who killed Georgi Markov on Westminster Bridge.
Experienced assassin, Basil thinks.
It figures they'd use the Bulgars, Ritter observed. They're the Eastern Bloc's Murder Incorporated, but they're still communists, and they're chess players, not high noon types.
But we still haven't figured out how to warn the Vatican.
Can we talk to the nuncio about this?
They'd all had a little time to think through that question, and now it was time to face it again. The papal nuncio was the Vatican's ambassador to the United States, Giovanni Cardinal Sabatino. Sabatino was a longtime member of the Pope's own diplomatic service, and was well regarded by the State Department's career foreign service officers, both for his sagacity and his discretion.
Can we do it in such a way as not to compromise the source? Greer wondered.
We can say some Bulgarian talked too much.
Pick that fictional source carefully, Judge, Ritter warned. Remember, the DS has that special subunit.
It reports directly to their Politburo, and they don't write much down, according to what sources we have over there. Kinda like the commie version of Albert Anastasia. This Strokov guy is one of them, or so we have heard. We could say their party chairman talked to a mistress. He has a few, Greer suggested. The Director of Intelligence had all manner of information on the intimate habits of world leaders, and the Bulgarian party boss was a man of the people in the most immediate of senses. Of course, if this ever leaked, life might get difficult for the women in question, but adultery had its price, and the Bulgarian chairman was such a copious drinker that he might not remember to whom he'd never said what would be attributed to him. That might serve to salve their consciences a little.
Sounds plausible, Ritter opined.
When could we see the Nuncio? Moore asked.
Middle of the week, maybe, Ritter suggested again.
They all had a full week before them. The judge would be on the hill doing budget business until Wednesday morning.
Where?
They couldn't bring him here, after all. The churchman wouldn't come. Too much potential unpleasantness if anyone noticed. And Judge Moore couldn't go to the Nuncio. His face also was too well known by the Washington establishment.
Foggy Bottom, Greer thought out loud.
Moore went to see the Secretary of State often enough, and the Nuncio wasn't exactly a stranger there.
That'll work, the DCI decided. Let's get it set up.
Moore stretched. He hated having to work on a Sunday. Even a judge of the appeals court got weekends off.
There's still the issue of what they can actually do with the information, Ritter warned them.
What is Basil doing?
He's got his Rome station rooting around. Only 5 of them, but he's going to send some more troops from London tomorrow just in case they try to make their hit on Wednesday. That's when His Holiness appears in public. I gather he has a pretty busy work schedule, too.
Shame he can't call off the ride around the plaza, but I guess he wouldn't listen if anybody asked.
Not hardly, Moore agreed. He didn't bring up the word from Sir Basil that Ryan had been dispatched to Rome. Ritter would just throw another conniption fit, and Moore wasn't up to that on a Sunday.
Ryan arose early, as usual, had his breakfast, and caught a taxi to St. Peter's. It was good to walk around the square, which was almost entirely round, of course, just to stretch his legs. It seemed odd that here, inside the capital of the Italian Republic, was a titularly sovereign state whose official language was Latin. He wondered if the Caesars would have liked that or not, the last home of their language also being the home of the agency that had brought down their world-spanning empire. But he couldn't go to the Forum to ask whatever ghosts lived there. The church commanded his attention. There were no words for something that large. The funds to build it had necessitated the indulgence selling that had sparked Martin Luther to post his protest on the cathedral door and so start the Reformation, something the nuns at St. Matthew's had not approved of, but for which the Jesuits of his later life had taken rather a broader view. The Society of Jesus also owed its existence to the Reformation. They'd been founded to fight against it. That didn't much matter at the moment. The basilica beggared description, and it seemed a fit headquarters for the Roman Catholic Church. He walked in and saw that, if anything, the interior seemed even more vast than the outside. You could play a football game in there. A good 100 yards away was the main altar reserved for use by the Pope himself, under which was the crypt where former popes were buried, including, tradition had it, Simon Peter himself. "Thou art Peter," Jesus was quoted in the Gospel, "and upon this rock I shall build my church." Well, with the help of some architects and what must have been an army of workers, they'd certainly built a church here. Jack felt drawn into it as though it were God's own personal house. The cathedral in Baltimore would scarcely have been an alcove here. Looking around, he saw the tourists, also staring at the ceiling with open mouths.
How had they built this place without structural steel? Jack wondered. It was all stone resting on stone.
Those old guys really knew their stuff, Ryan reflected. The sons of those engineers now worked for Boeing or NASA. He spent a total of 20 minutes walking around, then reminded himself that he wasn't, after all, a tourist. This had once been the site of the original Roman Circus Maximus. The big racetrack for chariots, like those in the movie Ben-Hur, had then been torn down and a church built here, the original St. Peter's. But over time, that church had deteriorated, and so a century-plus-long project to build this one had been undertaken and was finished in the 16th century, Ryan remembered. He went back outside to survey the area once again. Much as he looked for alternatives, it seemed that his first impression had been the correct one. The Pope got in his car there, drove around that way, and the place of greatest vulnerability was right about there. The problem was that there was a semicircular space, perhaps 200 yards long. Okay, he thought, time to do some analysis. The shooter would be a pro. A pro would have two considerations. One, getting a good shot off. And two, getting the hell out of here alive. So Ryan turned to see potential exit routes. To the left, closest to the facade of the church, people would really pile up there in their desire to get the first look at the Pope as he came out. Farther down, the open vehicle path widened somewhat, increasing the range of the shot. Something to be avoided. But the shooter still needed to get his ass out of Dodge City, and the best way to do that was toward the side street where Sharp had parked the day before. You could stash a car there, probably, and if you made it that far, you'd go pedal to the metal and race the hell off to wherever you had a backup car parked. A backup, because the cops would sure as hell be looking for the first one, and Rome had a goodly supply of police officers who'd run through fire to catch whoever had popped a cap on the Pope. Back to the shooting place. He wouldn't want to be in the thickest part of the crowd, so he wouldn't want to be too close to the church. But he'd want to boogie out through that arch. Maybe 60 or 70 yards. 10 seconds, maybe. With a clear path? Yeah, about that. Double it, just to be sure. He'd probably yell something like, "There he goes!" as a distraction. It might make him easier to identify later, but Colonel Strokov will be figuring to sleep Wednesday night in Sofia. Check flight times, Jack told himself. If he takes the shot and gets away, he won't be swimming home, will he? No, he'll opt for the fastest way out, unless he has a really deep hidey hole here in Rome. That was a possibility. The problem was that he was dealing with an experienced field spook, and he could have a lot of things planned. But this was reality, not a movie, and professionals kept things simple, because even the simplest things could go to shit in the real world. He'll have at least one backup plan. Maybe more, but sure as hell he'll have one. Dress up like a priest, maybe. There were a lot of them in evidence. Nuns, too. More than Ryan had ever seen. How tall is Strokov? Anything over 5'8" and he'd be too tall for a nun. But if he dressed as a priest, you could hide a fucking RPG in a cassock. That was a pleasant thought. But how fast could one run in a cassock? That was a possible downside. You have to assume a pistol, probably a suppressed pistol. A rifle? No, its dangers lay in its virtues. It was so long that the guy standing next to him could bat the barrel off target, and he'd never get a good round off. An AK-47, maybe, able to go rock and roll? But no, it was only in the movies that people fired machine guns from the hip. Ryan had tried it with his M16 at Quantico. It felt real John Wayne, but you just couldn't hit shit that way. The sights the gunnery sergeants had all told his class at the basic school are there for a reason. Like Wyatt Earp shooting on TV. Draw and fire from the hip. It just didn't work unless your other hand was on the fucker's shoulder. The sights are there for a reason, to tell you where the weapon is pointed, because the bullet you're shooting is about a third of an inch in diameter,
and you are, in fact, shooting at a target just that small, and a hiccup could jerk you off target, and under stress, your aim just gets worse. Unless you're used to the idea of killing people. Like Boris Strokov, colonel of the Derzhavna Sugarnost. What if he was one of those who just didn't rattle? Like Audie Murphy of the 3rd Infantry Division in World War II. But how many people like that were around? Murphy had been 1 in 8 million American soldiers, and nobody had seen that deadly quality in him before it just popped out on the battlefield, probably surprising even him. Murphy himself probably never appreciated how different he was from everybody else. Strokov is a pro, Jack reminded himself. And so he'll act like a pro. He'll plan every detail, especially the getaway. You must be Ryan, a British voice said quietly. Jack turned to see a pale man with red hair. Who are you? Mick King, the man replied. Sir Basil sent the 4 of us down. Sussing the area out? How obvious am I? Ryan worried suddenly. You could well be an architecture student. King blew it off. What do you think? I think the shooter would stand right about here and try to boogie on out that way, Jack said, pointing. King looked around before speaking. It's a dicey proposition, however one plans it, with all the people sure to be here, but yes, that does look the most promising option, the spook agreed. If I were planning to do it myself, I'd want to use a rifle from up there. We'll need to have somebody topside to handle that possibility. Agreed. I'll have John Sparrow go up there. The chap with short hair, over there. He brought a ton of cameras with him. One more man to camp out in the street that way. Our bird will probably have a car to skip town with, and that's where I'd park it. A little too convenient, don't you think? Hey, I'm an ex-Marine, not a chess master, Ryan replied. But it was good to have somebody second-guessing him. There were a lot of tactical possibilities here, and everybody read a map a little differently, and Bulgarians might well study out of a different playbook altogether. It's a pig of a mission they've given us. Best hope is that this Strokov fellow doesn't show up. Oh, here he is, King said, handing Ryan an envelope. It was full of 8x10 prints, actually of pretty good quality. Nick Thompson told me he has lifeless eyes, Ryan said, looking at one of them. Does seem rather a cold chap, doesn't he? When we come here Wednesday, we're going to be carrying. I certainly shall be, King said positively. 9mm Browning. There ought to be a few more at the embassy. I know you can shoot accurately under pressure, Sir John, he added, with casual respect. It doesn't mean I like to, pal. And the best engagement range for any pistol was contact range, holding the gun right against the other bastard. Kind of hard to miss that way. It would even cut the noise down, too. Plus, it was a hell of a good way to tell someone not to do anything untoward. For the next 2 hours, the 5 men walked the piazza, but they kept coming back to the same place. We can't cover it all, not without 100 men, Mick King finally said. And if you can't be strong everywhere, you might as well pick one place and be strong there. Jack nodded, remembering how Napoleon had ordered his generals to come up with a plan for protecting France from invasion. And when a senior officer had spread his troops evenly along the borders, he'd heartlessly inquired if the guy was trying to protect against smuggling. So yeah. If you couldn't be strong everywhere, then you planned to be strong somewhere, and prayed that you'd picked the right spot. The key, as always, was to put yourself into the other guy's head, just as they'd taught him to do as an intelligence analyst. Think the way your adversary thinks, and stop him that way. It sounded so good and so easy, theoretically. It was rather different in the field, however. They caught Tom Sharp walking into the basilica, and together they went off to a restaurant for lunch and a talk. "Sir John is right," King said. "The best spot is over on the left side."
We have photos of the bugger. We put you, John, he said to Sparrow, atop the colonnade with your cameras. Your job will be to sweep the crowd and try to spot the bastard and radio your information to us. Sparrow nodded, but his face showed what he thought of the job as the beers arrived.
Mick, you had it right from the beginning, Sparrow said. It's a pig of a job. We ought to have the whole bloody SAS regiment here, and even that would not be enough.
The 22nd Special Air Service Regiment was actually just a company or two in size, brilliant troopers that they were.
Ours is not to reason why, lad, Sharp told them all. So good to know that Basil knows his Tennyson.
The resulting snorts around the lunch table told the tale. What about radios? Jack asked.
On the way by courier, Sharp answered. Small ones, they'll fit in a pocket, and they have earpieces, but not small microphones, unfortunately.
Shit, Ryan observed. The Secret Service would have exactly what they needed for this mission, but you couldn't just call them up and have them delivered. What about the Queen's protective detail? Who does that?
The Metropolitan Police, I believe.
Why? Lapel mics, Ryan answered. It's what the Secret Service uses at home.
I can ask, Sharp responded. Good idea, Jack. They might well have what we need.
They ought to cooperate with us, Mick King thought aloud.
I'll see to it this afternoon, Sharp promised.
Yeah, Ryan thought. We'll be the best-equipped guys ever to blow a mission.
They call this beer? Sparrow asked after his first sip. Better than American canned piss, another of the new arrivals thought aloud.
Jack didn't rise to the bait. Besides, you went to Italy for the wine, not the beer.
What do we know about Strokov? Ryan asked.
They faxed me the police file on him, Sharp reported.
Read it this morning. He's 5'11", about 15 stone. Evidently he likes to eat too much.
So, not an athlete. Certainly not a sprinter.
Brown hair, fairly thick.
Good language skills. Speaks accented English, but reportedly speaks French and Italian like a native. Thought to be an expert with small arms. He's been in the business 20 years. Age 43 or so. Selected for the special DS assassination unit about 15 years ago, with 8 kills attributed to him, possibly more. We don't have good information on that.
Delightful chap, sounds like, Sparrow thought aloud.
He reached for one of the photos.
Ought not to be difficult to spot. Better to get some of these prints reduced to pocket size so that we can all carry them with us.
Done, Sharp promised.
The embassy had its own little photo lab, mainly for his use. Ryan looked around the table. At least it was good to be surrounded by professionals. Given the chance to perform, they probably wouldn't blow it. Like a good bunch of Marines. It was not all that much, but it was something.
What about sidearms? Ryan asked next.
All the 9mm Brownings we need, Tom Sharp assured him.
Ryan wanted to ask if they had hollow point ammunition, but they probably just had military issue hardball.
That Geneva Convention bullshit.
The 9mm Parabellum cartridge was thought by Europeans to be powerful, but it was hardly a BB compared to the .45 Colt with which he'd been trained. So then why did he own a Browning High Power, Jack asked himself. But the one he had at home was loaded with Federal 147 grain hollow points, regarded by the American FBI as the only useful bullet to shoot out of the thing, good both for penetration and for expanding to the diameter of a dime inside the target's body, to make him bleed out in a hurry.
"He'd better be bloody close," Mick King announced. "Haven't fired one of the things in years."
Which reminded Jack that England did not have the gun culture America has, even in their security services. James Bond was someone from the movies, Ryan had to remember. Ryan himself was probably the best pistol shot in the room, and he was a long way from being an expert. The pistols Sharp would hand out would be military issue, the ones with invisible sights and crummy grips.
The one Ryan owned had pockmired grips that fit his hand so nicely that it might have been a custom-made glove. Damn, nothing about this job was going to be easy. Okay. John, you'll be atop the colonnade. Find out how you get there and arrange to get up there Wednesday morning early.
Right. He had press credentials to make that easy. I'll recheck the timing for everything as well.
Good, Sharp replied. We'll spend the afternoon going over the ground more. Look for things we may have overlooked. I'm thinking we put one man over on the side street to try and spot our friend Strokov coming in. If we spot him, we shadow him all the way in.
Not stop him out there? Ryan asked.
Better to get him in closer, Sharp thought out loud. More of us, less chance for him to bolt.
If we are on to him, Jack, he won't be doing anything untoward, will he?
We'll see to that.
Will he be that predictable? Jack worried.
He's doubtless been here already.
Indeed. We could just spot him today or tomorrow, couldn't we?
I wouldn't bet the ranch on it, Jack shot back.
We play the card we are dealt, Sir John, King said, and hope for luck.
There was no arguing with that, Ryan realized.
If I were planning this operation, I'd be trying very hard to keep it simple. The most important preparation he'll be making is up here.
Sharp tapped the side of his head.
He, too, will be somewhat tense, no matter how experienced he is in this business. Yes, he's a clever bugger, but he is not bloody Superman. The key to his success is surprise. Well, he doesn't really have that, does he? And blown surprise is the worst nightmare of a field officer. Lose that, and everything comes apart like a wrecked watch. Remember, if he sees one thing that he doesn't like, he will probably just walk away and plan to come back again. There is no clock on this mission, from his point of view.
Think so? Ryan wasn't the least bit sure of that.
Yes, I do. If there were, from an operational standpoint, they would well have executed the mission already, and the Pope would already be chatting directly with God. According to what I've heard from London, this mission has been in planning for more than 6 weeks. So clearly he's taking his time. I'll be very surprised if it happens day after tomorrow, but we must act as though it will.
I wish I had your confidence, ma'am.
Sir John, field officers think and act like field officers, whatever their nationality, Sharp said with confidence. Our mission is a difficult one, yes, but we speak his language, as it were. If this were a balls-out mission, it would have been done already.
Agreed, gentlemen, he asked, and got nods from around the table, except from the American.
What if we're missing something? Ryan wondered.
That is a possibility, Sharp admitted, but it's a possibility we have to both live with and discount. We have only the information we have, and we must design our plan around that.
Not much choice for us, is it, Sir John? Sparrow asked.
We have only what we have.
True, Ryan admitted rather miserably. There had come the sudden thought that other things might be happening as well. What if there were a diversion? What if somebody tossed firecrackers to draw eyes toward the noise and away from the real action? That, he suddenly thought, was a real possibility.
Damn. What's this about, Ryan? Ritter asked, storming into Judge Moore's office.
Basil thought that since Beatrix was a CIA operation from the get-go, why not send one of our officers down there to take a look at things?
I don't see that it can hurt anything, Moore told his DDO. Who the hell does Ryan think he's working for? Bob, why don't you just settle down? What the hell can he do to hurt things? Damn it, Arthur! Settle down, Robert, Moore shot back in the voice of a judge used to having his own way on everything from the weather on down.
Arthur, Ritter said, calming down a whisker, it's not a place for him.
I see no reason to object, Bob. None of us think anything's going to happen anyway, do we?
Well,
Oh, I suppose not, the DDO admitted. So he's just broadening his horizons, and from what he learns, he'll be a better analyst, won't he? Maybe so, but I don't like having some desk sitter playing field spook. He isn't trained for this. Bob, he used to be a Marine, Moore reminded him. And the U.S. Marine Corps had its own cachet, independent of the CIA. He's not going to wet his pants on us, is he? I suppose not. And all he's going to do is look around at nothing happening. And the exposure to some field officers will not do his education any harm, will it? They're Brits, not our guys, Ritter objected weakly. The same guys who brought the rabbit out for us. Okay, Arthur. I'll give you this one. Bob, you throw a hell of a conniption fit, but why not use them for something important? Yes, Judge, but the DO is my shop to run. You want me to get Rick Nolfi into this? You think it's necessary? Ritter shook his head. No, I expect not. Then we let the Brits run this mini-op and keep it cool here at Langley until we can interview the rabbit and quantify the threat to the Pope. All right? Yes, Arthur. And the Deputy Director, Operations of the Central Intelligence Agency, headed back to his office. Dinner went well. The Brits made good company, especially when the talk turned to non-mission-related things. All were married. Three had kids, with one expecting his first shortly. "You have two, as I recall," Mick King asked Jack. "Yeah, and number two arrived on a busy night." "Too bloody right," Ray Stones, one of the new arrival, agreed with a laugh. "How did the missus take it?" "Not too bad after little Jack arrived, but the rest of the evening was subpar." "I believe it," King observed. "So, who told us that the Bulgarians want to kill the Pope?" Sparrow asked. "It's KGB that wants his ass," Jack replied. "We just got a defector out. He's in a safe house, and he's singing like the girl in Aida. This is the most important thing so far." "Reliable information?" King inquired. "We think it's gold-plated and copper-bottomed, yeah. Sir Basil has bought into it. That's why he flew you guys down," Jack let them know, in case they hadn't already figured that one out. "I've met the rabbit myself, and I think he's the real deal." "CIA operation?" This was sharp. Jack nodded. "Correct. We had an operational problem, and you guys were kind enough to help us out. I'm not cleared to say much more. Sorry." They all understood. They didn't want their asses exposed by loose talk about a black operation. "This must go to Andropov himself. The Pope's giving them trouble in Poland, is it?" "It would seem so. Maybe he has command of more divisions than they appreciate. Even so, this seems a little extreme. How will the world see the assassination of His Holiness?" King wondered aloud. "Evidently, they fear that less than a total political collapse in Poland," Mick Stones thought out loud. "And they're afraid that he might be able to bring that about. The sword and the spirit, as Napoleon said, Mick. The spirit always wins in the end." "Yes, I reckon so. And here we are, at the epicenter of the world of the spirit." "My first time here," Stones said. "It is bloody impressive. I must bring the family down here sometime." "They do know their food and wine," Sparrow observed, going through his veal. "What about the local police?" "Rather good, actually," Sharp told him. "Pity we can't enlist their assistance. They know the territory. It is their patch, after all." "But these guys are the pros from Dover," Ryan thought, with some degree of hope. Just that there weren't enough of them. "Tom, you talked to London about the radios?" "Ah, yes, Jack. They're sending us 10. Earpieces and lapel microphones to speak into. Sideband, rather like what the army use. I don't know if they're encrypted, but fairly secure in any case. and we'll use proper radio discipline. So, at least we'll be able to communicate clearly. We'll practice with them tomorrow afternoon. And Wednesday? We'll arrive about 9 in the morning, pick our individual surveillance areas, and mill about while the crowd arrives.
This isn't what they trained me for in the Corps, Ryan thought aloud.
Sir John, Mick King responded, this isn't what they trained any of us for. Yes, we are all experienced intelligence officers, but this really is a job for someone in the protective services, like the police constables who guard Her Majesty and the PM, or your Secret Service chaps.
Hell of a way to earn a living, this is.
Yes, Mick, I expect we'll all appreciate them a little more after this lot, Ray Stones observed, to general agreement around the table.
John, Ryan turned to Sparrow. You've got the most important job, spotting this motherfucker for the rest of us.
Lovely, Sparrow replied.
All I have to do is examine 5,000-plus faces for the one that might or might not be there.
Lovely, the spook repeated.
What will you be using?
I have 3 Nikon cameras and a good assortment of lenses. I think tomorrow I might buy some 7x50 binoculars also. I just hope I can find a good perch to scan from. The height of the parapet worries me. There's a dead space extending out from the base of the columns about 30 yards or so that I can't see at all. That limits what I can do, lads.
Not much choice, Jack thought out loud. You can't see shit from ground level.
That is a problem we have, Sparrow agreed. Our best choice would be 2 men. One, actually more than one, on each side with good spotting glasses. But we lack the manpower, and we'd have to get permission from the Pope's own security people, which is, I gather, quite out of the question.
Getting them involved would be useful, but...
But we can't let the whole world know about the rabbit.
Yeah, I know. The Pope's life is secondary to that consideration.
Isn't that just great? Ryan growled.
What is the security of your country worth, Sir John?
And ours also, King asked rhetorically.
More than his life, Ryan answered.
Yeah, I know. But that doesn't mean I have to like it.
Has any Pope ever been murdered? Sharp asked.
Nobody knew the answer.
Somebody tried once. The Swiss guards fought a stonewall action to protect his retreat. Most of them went down hard, but the Pope escaped alive, Ryan said, remembering something from a comic book he'd read at St. Matthew's in the...
What was it?
4th grade or so?
I wonder how good they are, those Swiss chaps, Stones asked.
They're pretty enough in the striped uniforms. Probably well-motivated.
Question of training, really, Sharp observed.
That's the difference between a civilian and a soldier. Training. The chaps in plain clothes are probably well briefed, but if they carry pistols, are they allowed to use them? They work for a church, after all. Probably not trained to shoot people outright.
You had that guy jump out from a crowd and fire off a starter pistol at the Queen.
On the way to Parliament, wasn't it? Ryan remembered. There was a cavalry officer on a horse, right there. I was surprised he didn't cut the asshole in half with his saber. That would have been my instinct. But he didn't.
Parades or just for ceremonial occasions. You probably couldn't cut cold butter with it, Sparrow said. Nearly trampled the bastard with his horse, though.
The Secret Service would have dropped him on the spot.
Sure, the gun was loaded with blanks, Ryan said. But it damn sure looked and sounded like the real thing.
Her Majesty kept her head screwed on pretty tight. I would have shit myself.
I'm sure Her Majesty availed herself of the proper facilities at Westminster Palace.
She has her own loo there, you know, King told the American.
In the event, he was some disturbed fellow, doubtless cutting out paper dolls in a mental hospital now, Sharp said. But like every other British subject, his heart had stopped cold watching the incident on TV, and he too had been surprised that the lunatic had survived the event. Had one of the yeomen of the tower been there with his ceremonial fighting spear, called a partisan,
He surely would have been pinned to the pavement like a butterfly in a collection box. Perhaps God did look after fools, drunks, and little children after all. So, if Strokov does show up and does take his shot, you suppose the local Italians will do for him?
One can hope, King said.
Wouldn't that be just great, Jack thought. The professionals can't protect the Pope, but the local waiters and clothing salesmen beat the fucker to death. That'd look great on NBC Nightly News. Back in Manchester, the rabbit and his family finished yet another superb dinner from Mrs. Thompson.
What does an ordinary English worker eat? Zaitsev asked.
Not quite this well, Kingshot admitted.
He sure as hell didn't.
But we try to take decent care of our guests, Oleg.
Have I told you enough about Minister? He asked next. He is all I know.
The security service had picked his brain pretty thoroughly on the subject that afternoon, going over every single fact at least 5 times.
You've been most helpful, Oleg Ivanich. Thank you.
In fact, he'd given the security service quite a lot. Most often the way you caught such penetration agents was by identifying the information he'd transferred. Only a limited number of people would have access to all of it, and the 5 people would observe all of them until one did something difficult to explain. Then they would see who arrived at the dead drop site to retrieve the package, and from that they'd get the bonus of identifying his KGB control officer, and get 2 breaks for the price of 1. Or perhaps even more, because the case officer would be working more than 1 agent, and the discoveries could branch out like the limbs of a tree. Then you tried to arrest a peripheral agent before going after the main target.